Welcome, Guillermo. How are you?
Good. Thanks for having me, Mark. Appreciate it.
No, my pleasure. You've got a super impressive background, and I want to be able to at least touch on some of it. I know we just one of my pet peeves is people's names not being pronounced the way I think they're more interesting to be pronounced.
Yeah.
But just to start, can you present what your last name really, really is supposed to sound like?
Well, it's German, and if you actually pronounce it with the two umlauts over the O, it's Zünlein.
Okay, and but you've become accustomed to Americans calling you
Sunline.
Okay, and as we said, I'm going to go Guillermo. We're not doing Bill, so Guillermo is going to be great. So welcome to the Leaders Who Care series. A shout out to Ethan Mayers for the intro and so on, and if you could. Briefly, sometimes I have to tell people, don't tell the whole story right now, because then I have nothing else to say. But if you can briefly, family, where you're from, tell a little bit about you, and then we'll hit it. How's that sound?
All right, sounds good. I mean, high level, obviously with a Spanish first name and a German last name, I was born in Argentina. Came to the United States when I was 6 years old, not speaking a word of English. That's why I went by Bill for a long time. But ended up growing up in the San Jose in the Bay Area, and went to school there. I'm a lawyer by training. From there, I went into the Marine Corps on active duty for 4 years, got out and co-founded an internet company in San Francisco. And basically that launched me on a 24 year career, doing a variety of different technology startups.
Yeah, no kidding. What about family and stuff here?
So my immediately family is all in the U.S. My dad passed away a couple years ago. My mom lives in Boulder. I have a sister in also in Boulder. But more importantly, I have three amazing kids. They're coming into birthday season, so they're 21, 23, 21, and 17.
Wow. Close together. I got three boys. I know you told me this. I have three boys. You have?
Girl, boy.
Okay, that's right. And my two young ones are 17 months apart. The other one's a little bit older. And it's a lot of fun.
Yeah. Well, what's amazing is that you can tell that they come from the same genetic material, and yet they are three completely different human beings.
That's great, though, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's amazing.
Just think of the startups they could start together with that.
Well, ironically, that's what my 21-year-old is doing now. He's in the process of starting a little e-commerce company. So I'm occasionally helping him out with that.
All right. Well, he's got a good mentor for sure. So to say you've touched on a whole bunch of ventures would be an understatement for sure. If someone looks at your background. But before we delve deeper, when did you discover what your why was? Or is it?
Yeah, it's funny that, starting with why really kind of influenced me a few years ago. And even right now on my current website, I've got my why up there. But, thinking about this question, I don't know when I actually came up with the actual why, but I think it's an evolving thing for everybody. My initial thought, I remember back when I was 11 years old, thinking that someday I was going to be the mission commander for the first Martian colony. So that was a very specific recurring dream for an 11-year-old to have. Mm-hmm. But over time, that's morphed a little bit, and now it's kind of gotten a little bit more general. My why, as I stated, is to help humanity thrive by exploring and settling extreme environments. And for me, I've also expanded it to be space, oceans, and Earth.
Yeah, I found that incredibly, incredibly fascinating. And but before I even go there further, you mentioned briefly, education-wise, economics and a JD. Education, and then Marine Corps judge advocate, which is interesting in its own right, to a whole diverse array of entrepreneurships, from speech, communications, teaching, ocean, space, you name it. I mean, there's a lot there. You got to admit it. And share how that journey evolved and why you do what you do, and so much more.
Well, I think the entrepreneurial part, you know, the 20 plus year career doing a variety of different startups, both for profit and nonprofit. I think that really evolved from my, what I really enjoy about it is the creative aspect of it, right? Finding a problem in the world or finding some sort of gap that needs to be filled, starting with a blank slate and coming up with an idea, bringing together people, bringing together the resources and kind of growing into something that becomes real. I think for me, that's the common thread through one of the two common threads, I think, through all of the different ventures that I did, is that I was very fascinated and passionate about the creative aspect of it, which, by the way, has its limitations in that I'm not the best person to actually run and grow the businesses or the organizations or the problems. I'm good at bringing it all together and kind of creating everything and getting the ball moving. But then I have to be able to hand it off to somebody else who's much better at taking everything through the next stage. So for example, I think I've got, at last count, I think it was 8 for-profit companies and 3 nonprofits. And today, 3 of the for-profits and 1 of the nonprofits is still around being run by other people who've taken over. So that requires a certain amount of comfort with letting go. And, you know, kind of, it's almost like creating a baby and then turning it over to somebody else for them to raise it.
That's what I always say. I said, it's giving the baby to the babysitter for the first time is not an easy thing to do for a founder.
Correct. Exactly.
So, did you, cause you have, it's kind of related, like oceans, you know, ocean, space, land. It's kind of, there's some that are related, but there's some, you can make them all related to some degree to different entrepreneurships you went into, but did they just happen because you met somebody, or like speech, let's say speech recognition, you met somebody, a personal experience, how did they happen?
Yeah, I mean, if you want to go into details on that, right? So the first startup, I was actually on active duty in the Marine Corps, and my old roommate, who was also one of my best friends in college, is a technologist. He's a brilliant technology visionary. In fact, he's currently co-founder and chairman of his own venture-backed startup up in San Francisco. But he had an idea to start a company, an internet company. This was back in 96, 97. And he wanted me to come along and do it with him. So I ended up leaving the Marine Corps active duty in 99. And we moved up to San Francisco to be with him to start this company. Focusing it on speech recognition was really his idea, and it was a timely one. So that kind of got me going on the startup side. Mm-hmm. After we sold that company is when I realized I enjoyed what I was just saying earlier. I enjoyed the creative aspect of starting that company. Mm-hmm. I wasn't necessarily passionate about the speech recognition part. That was his passion. So I just figured whatever startups I do next, had to be in areas that I was passionate about. And so it forced me to do self-assessment. What am I passionate about? And I ended up kind of reviewing my life at the time. I think I was like 33 or something. And I came up with 5 things that I thought I was passionate about at the time, and I probably still am today. One is anything having to do with international anything. Mm-hmm. And then the others are sports, music, and then the oceans generally, or specifically and more generally, just environmental causes. And then the last one was space. And space was the one that went all the way back to when I was 11. And so I figured that's what I want to focus on next. And that's kind of led me down this path of space and space adjacent or space similar ventures.
No, it's that's pretty cool. And so let's talk a little bit about entrepreneurial vision, but also, you know, imagination and then investment that goes along with that. The great things about what's happening now, I find, is we're being brought back to when we were kids, the imagination we had when we saw the astronauts and all sorts of things going on that we really missed for a long time. You know, there's other stuff that was going on, but that was like real imagination, right? And the vision a lot now is coming from people like yourself in the private sector, you know, the Bezos, the Musks, whatever, the ones that you know, people sometimes say, well, you know, is the private sector the right one to do all that? But they're showing that the private sector can do it all and make things happen. And so, as I said, it's reminded us of being kids. How did you become interested in, you kind of mentioned a little bit before, sustainable settlement in extreme environments, the three you talked about, you know, land, sea, and space. And then from that, you talked about, as a kid, thinking about Mars, but you decided to pick Venus instead with your current vision. Talk about that.
Oh boy. So you wrapped a lot of questions all in one,
let's start with this, you know, sustainable environment in extreme places.
Yeah. Well, let's start with the sustainable part. I think, cause that was a late addition, probably over the last five or plus years. And it really came about mostly because I realized that I'd been thinking a lot about off-world settlements and bringing humanity off-planet. And in the meantime, there are a lot of issues here on Earth that we're trying to fix. And the word sustainability started taking on increased sense of urgency just in the general discussions, not even having to do with off-world settlement. And I realized that a lot of the thoughts that go into what it would take to take humanity off planet necessarily also include sustainability, because these off-world settlements have to be self-sustaining. Mm-hmm. You're not going to be able to rely on anything coming from Earth, at least not in the long term. And so I started realizing that a lot of the folks, the people, the friends, the colleagues that I was talking with about off-world settlement, they were working on solutions for space that had a dual use here on Earth. And so it was easy to translate a lot of their work to solutions for problems here on Earth. And so it was easy to kind of add that sustainability part to what I was doing. But all the other stuff, for me, it was mostly realizing that humans were gonna have to go places that the human body's not designed to be or to go. And that's in space, but we also have environments like that here on Earth, whether it's underwater, whether it's high altitudes, whether it's deserts, whether it's deserts. I just said that. There's a lot of places here on Earth that are very difficult for human beings. And for that, you have to also set up sustainable settlements. So it kind of all wrapped in together, but it all kind of started with this idea of how do you take humanity off planet for the long term.
So are you going to build an Atlantis underwater?
I thought about that. Someone asked me a couple years ago. You asked me a little bit about Venus and we'll get to that, and I'll talk a little bit about my thoughts on putting humans in the Venusian atmosphere. But somebody asked me a couple years ago, where do you want to be 5 years from now? Where do you want to be 10 years from now? And my answer at the time, and maybe today, is 5 years from now, I'd love to be living in an underwater city working on a project that's taking humans to Venus.
That is awesome. So you got them both at the same time.
Yeah, yeah.
So then the question everybody's going to ask is, why Venus versus Mars, Jupiter, or whatever?
Yeah, I think one of the issues that I always had with off-world settlements, and I think most people have, is, you know, there's a lot of obstacles to overcome when you're taking humans off planet. Mm-hmm. We're designed to be here on Earth. We're not designed to go off planet. And so whether you're thinking about permanent off-world settlements in orbit or on the moon or on Mars or wherever, you've got to deal with a lot of issues related to the human body, whether that's breathable atmosphere or food or water or radiation or whatever it is. And one of the things that always bothered me with all of these is that on a long term, we had technological solutions for just about everything. The only thing that we could not figure out how to solve is gravity or lack of gravity. Mm-hmm. And that's something that we don't yet have a solution for, at least a good technological solution for, in part because scientists still don't understand how it actually works. And so I started looking around keeping in mind, I'm not an engineer, I'm not a scientist, right? I started looking around trying to figure out, is there anywhere in the solar system where we can have 1G of gravity? Because most people don't know this, up in the space station, you see them all floating around, they're basically in microgravity. On the moon, it's 1/6 gravity here on Earth, and on Mars, it's 38% of Earth's gravity. So scientists still aren't sure what effect that will have on the human body over time. And when I say over time, I mean over several generations, right? And so I started looking around the solar system. Are there places where scientists feel that we could have 1G of gravity? And it turns out that not on the surface of Venus, but about 50 kilometers off the surface in the Venusian atmosphere, scientists believe that it experienced 1G of gravity. And it just happens that at that spot in the atmosphere, it's also right about the right temperature for the human body. It's a little on the hot side, but it's bearable. Also, there's enough atmosphere left above you in the atmosphere that you get protection from the radiation of the sun, even though you're closer to the sun and you don't have a magnetic field like the Earth has. Mm-hmm. In that atmosphere, it is thick enough that a standard normal Earth air, right, 80% nitrogen, 20% oxygen, would actually float. If you had a balloon filled, if you just kind of filled up a balloon with normal breathable air from Earth and you put it in the Venusian atmosphere, it would actually float. So you don't have to deal with helium or hydrogen or hot air balloons or anything like that to make anything float. So if you think about it, you could create a huge dome, fill it with breathable air from Earth, and it would float in the Venusian atmosphere. Obviously, this is all theoretical. But that all of a sudden presents an interesting potential solution to potentially have a floating city in the Venusian atmosphere. You still have to deal with the fact, you know, it's not going to be perfect, obviously. You still have to deal with the fact that the atmosphere is not breathable. It's mostly CO2. But we have technology that can convert that into breathable air. And you have to deal with the fact that the Venusian atmosphere is made up of acidic clouds, sulfuric acid. But we also have technology that can deal with that. So you get past that and you actually have, you know, it's not going to be a picnic, right? It's not going to be a Shangri-La there. But I think what people forget when everyone looks at these sci-fi movies and these visions of lunar colonies and Martian colonies is that, number one, because of radiation on those planets or in those planetary bodies, people living there are going to have to basically live underground. And so they're going to have to kind of live as moles to have the most protection. And regardless, they're going to have to deal with the gravity issues. So, you know, there's trade-offs either way, no matter where you go.
Oh, there's trade-offs here too. And some people say we may have to live underground, you know, eventually also here.
Yeah.
I've heard that, and I'm certainly not a scientist by a long shot. Nor for that matter, am I religious. And I wonder, have you ever had any conversations with yourself or other people about, you know, the spiritual and we're supposed to be up there and how's this happened and all that whole thing?
It's funny timing for that question, because I actually have an email in my inbox from a friend of mine who sent me a whole long email about exactly that kind of discussion. And I actually snoozed that email until later tonight so I can respond to it. The short answer is yes, we've had discussions like that. I don't know if there's a clear answer for any of that. But yeah, that's certainly, and that's just one of many conversations if you think about it. It's if you're taking humanity off planet, let's say you're Elon and you're setting up a Martian colony and he wants to have 1 million people there in the next 20 years. Let's say he's successful in doing that. Well, there's a lot of questions to be had about how you set up those 1 million people. If essentially you're kind of getting to start humanity from scratch, mm-hmm. again, who do you send? You know, do you send all Americans, all Chinese, all Russians, all whatever? Do you spread it out? Do you send young people? Do you send old people? Do you send all scientists or engineers? Do you send all, I don't know. Do you send artists? Do you send, how do you organize it?
Is
it
doing Noah's, you're doing Noah's Ark thing.
Yeah, something like that. But also, like, how do you organize it? Do you organize it as a dictatorship, as a democracy, as a theocracy? Do you allow religion? Do you not allow religion? What kind of economy do you have? Do you even have an economy?
Make for a good lesson to go through that as a case study as to how you would set that up, because you think you'd be setting it up in what you think is the best way. And then you take that and you say, okay, now let's do that here.
Yeah, well, so here's the thing. So first of all, as I started thinking about all that, I realized that there are a lot of people out there much smarter than I am who have been thinking about these things for a long time. There's a lot of, especially academics who've thought about this. Obviously, a lot of science fiction writers have written about a lot of this stuff. So a lot of thought has gone into all of that. One of the things that's been interesting for me, as you were just saying about kind of applying it all here on Earth. Okay, I'm going to get philosophical here for a second. Right. So one of the things is, if you're going to export humanity to another planet or another planetary body, what does it mean to be human? When you say humanity, what does that mean? And I think most sci-fi, especially starting with Star Trek, kind of envisions that what's going to go off planet is going to be the best of humanity. Right? Mm-hmm. Our best scientists, our best creative people, our best engineers, our best leaders. But the reality is that what really makes humans human is the what's traditionally been called the duality of man, right? As a species, we are both the most creative animal species on Earth, but we're also the most destructive. Mm-hmm. We have the highest capacity for compassion and love, and yet we have the highest capacity to treat each other with hatred and just viciously. So what do we actually take forward? I think the show The Expanse, I think one of the reasons it was so popular, and at least one of the reasons I liked it, is because that vision of that future was taking both things off planet. You've got the good and the bad. Mm-hmm. So I don't know, because to your comment or your question, depending on how you're setting things up off planet, you may or may not be able to implement all.
Yeah, no doubt. It's a fascinating, you know, thought that you can have forever. It's kind of like as a kid lying in your bed and looking up and dreaming about the spaceship that could go on forever, and where would you end up?
Right.
Type of thing. If there was no fuel, no nothing, you just keep going. How far could you go? And, you know, and all the other conversations, when everything started, what was there? Well, there can't be nothing, because nothing has to be in something. And, you know, one of those never-ending conversations.
Yeah. So my big thing, I've also had recurring thoughts about what if you just created a big ship, put 1,000 people on, just sent the ship off and see where it goes, and let it go for generations and generations and generations. And it's cool thinking about like where it would go and what they would see and all that stuff. And my biggest thought is everything we were just talking about is, how do you organize those 1,000 people? How do you keep them together? How do you maintain the peace? Like, do you need security forces? Do you need a criminal justice system? Do you need a set of laws? Like, how do you do that? And do you limit it to 1,000 people? Because over generations, maybe it grows. What if it's 15,000 people, but your ship can only carry 1,000? You know, it's all the interpersonal things that I think are often overlooked, unless you're a science fiction writer. And for science fiction writers and filmmakers and things like that, that's where the most fun is in those interpersonal conflicts.
You kind of saw that with a Star Trek when they would visit other colonies, right? And imagining what it was, and whether it was just heads on a pedestal and they didn't need bodies, and they talked and did everything to people underground that were, you know, all sorts of things. So we certainly have the imagination up here. Maybe just don't know how to do it all. But it is fascinating in the sense of, if we could, what you're talking about, if we could think about what would it look like from scratch, should, if we're trying to speak semi-logically, help us determine, okay, what are we, if that's what we think it should be, how do we get there? Here.
Yes. Well, and kind of taking what you were just saying about Star Trek and kind of wrapping it all the way back around to leaders who care is, you know, one of the things that Gene Roddenberry explored a lot in Star Trek is different leadership styles. You know, what doesn't work, what works in different societies, whether it's the Klingons, the Vulcans, the humans, the Romulans, whatever. But even within within species, what works for Kirk as captain versus what works for Spock when he's in charge, or Sulu when he takes the con, you know?
Right.
So I think it's interesting to explore different leadership styles that may or may not lend themselves for different kinds of settlements or colonies or expeditions or missions, even here on Earth. Right, like when we do ocean exploration expeditions, what kind of leadership style do you need on a ship or inside a sub, or to lead the company that is doing that? And so, you know, one of the leaderships, you know, there people lead by different styles, whether it's through fear or through ego or whatever. And then there's the leadership style that leads via empathy, which is, I guess, the leaders who care, right? So.
Yeah. Yeah,
shameful plug. I wrapped it all back in for you.
You did very good. Thank you. Well, you know, you do make me think, though, because I compare a lot of things to sports, and it's almost the same as business. And I think it's almost to the point where even when leadership style doesn't apply to every single person in your company or on your team, you've actually got to understand people and what they care about. That ties into the purpose, if you will, of the whole company as well. So it's both fascinating and not necessarily easy. But if it was easy, everybody would win the championship, as they say in sports. Who's the one that can lead and manage most effectively? And I'd love to get your opinion on that too, because a CEO, a founder, actually you're good at job creation, it sounds like, because you get it going and then you hire somebody to run it. So that's good job creation, but how do you find, you know, a founder, a leader, whoever's in charge, in the sense of where we are right now in the world, about how leaders have realized that aligning with social environmental impact is actually good for business, and it's also good for attracting and keeping talent. How does a leader do all that? With respect to all the stakeholders they have, including employees, including their families, including the community, there's a lot going on for a leader. What's your thoughts on that based on what we're talking about?
So let's wrap it all the way back around to where you started, which is sports and coaching. So one of the things that I always say is that a lot of how I am as a leader was shaped, not created, but shaped and molded and reinforced by my training in the Marine Corps, which at its core, the Marine Corps is basically just a leadership training organization. That's almost all that we do. And one of the things that that I learned from that and about myself and about leadership in general is that to be a really good leader, you have to be able to adapt your leadership style. You have to be able to lead by various different styles. Because as you pointed out, not everyone on your team or whatever is gonna respond to the same kind of leadership style. Now, everyone's got their own natural leadership style that they default to, that they're most comfortable with, but there are all sorts of leadership styles. So if you think of about a sports coach coaching a team, that coach, at least the good ones, realize that some of the players on their team, and I'm gonna go with he because I'm thinking of NFL coaches and they're all male right now, but you know, he's going to know that some of his players need to be yelled at. Some of the players need to be told what to do and almost micromanaged. Some of the players need to be given complete freedom to do whatever they want. Some of the players need to be patted on the back. And
yeah,
they have to know how to adapt their own leadership, their own coaching styles to each of the players on the team, in large part because that's the only way they're going to get the most out of every single player so that they can get the most out of their entire team. So I do like looking at this through a sports analogy. Now, as far as your actual question, I think because everyone's got a different leadership style, getting, let's just say, CEOs to consider all the different factors that you were mentioning depends on their leadership style. So if somebody's very self-centered, and that's their leadership style, they have to be made to see that they personally will benefit if they look at all these other factors that you were mentioning. Mm-hmm. If somebody's leadership style is more empathetic, you almost don't have to do anything because they're going to, by default, think about all these things that you were just talking about. If somebody is leading through fear, they've got to see that dealing with all these issues that you were talking about is a tool that they can use in instilling fear in whoever it is that they're trying to lead. So I think each leadership style kind of lends itself to looking at all those issues you were talking about in different ways.
And you need a great captain and alternate captains in sports and champions within your company to be leaders too.
Yeah, that part is interesting because with different leadership styles, that may or may not be true, right? So if you look at a leader that leads through fear, maybe their number two person is somebody who's the executioner, you know, the person who's really like cracking the whip. On the other hand, if that number two is too good, then there's a challenge to the leader. And now I'm going back to Star Trek, I'm thinking of the Klingons, right? So that may or may not be true. I think for a leader who leads through empathy, that is totally true. Not only are you fostering a strong number two, you're fostering every single person in your team as a leader. And it's not just within your team, you're also fostering leadership within the external team, whether it's your board, whether it's your shareholders, whether it's your customers, your partners, you're trying as hard as you can to empower everybody else.
Now you get the leader who uses fear. If they're smart, they get their second in command to be the hugger.
Yeah. You can do the whole good cop, bad cop thing, you know, depending right. on how you want to do it. Yeah. And I think that's the thing is leadership really requires the leader to be self-aware, to know, at least for the good leaders, even the good leaders that are leading through fear or through ego or whatever, they have to know what makes them tick, what makes them good at what they do.
Yeah.
So they can focus on that. And then that will allow them to figure out what kind of team they need around them.
Yeah, without a doubt. You know, I interviewed a CEO almost a year ago. And he said, I remember, you know, well, because he said, I'm having the most fun being a CEO than I've ever had. I can be as vulnerable as I want to be, and I don't have to pretend like I know everything anymore.
Yep.
Brilliant. Isn't he? And it was actually much easier for him and much more productive, which is fascinating. It'll be, yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, and that also dictates what title or role you should have. Like, for example, you know, one of my best friends from college, who's the one that I co-founded the first startup with, I was just talking with him a few weeks ago. And as I said before, he's currently co-founder of a venture-backed startup up in San Francisco. And I asked him, you know, how's that company going? He goes, oh my God, it's going so great. Everything's great. The company's doing well. My life is great. I'm getting to focus on the stuff that I want to focus on. And I said, well, how did you work that out? And he goes, oh, I moved from CEO to chairman. And I let my co-founder be the sole CEO running the company. Mm-hmm. And he's running the company and I get to do all the other stuff that I want. Yeah. And he's still a leader. He's no less a leader now just because he's not CEO anymore. But now he's playing to his strengths and the CEO is playing to his strengths and everybody's happy.
So. Yeah. You know, most, at least US and some other countries, it seems like the presidents do much better after their president.
Yes.
You know, and not like their chairman, but it's after that.
Well, because I think then they get to do the stuff that they're good at and do the stuff that they're passionate about. They can cherry pick things,
yeah. Yeah.
Not have to deal with the day-to-day burden of, you know, being a leader.
I know. So last question on this part is, with all that's happened, and there's been plenty, as we all know, in the last couple of years, and hopefully 2022 will be the actual year to remember. And we don't remember the outlooks, except we learn from it. What are you most grateful for, and what are you most hopeful for?
I this is going to sound probably cliche, because I think given the pandemic over the last couple of years, everyone's probably I don't know if everyone would have the same answer, but I think everyone would agree to this, is I think what I'm most grateful for, most hopeful for, is the in-person interpersonal relationships. I think that all of us just kind of took that for granted for so long, and all of a sudden it all went away. Now for some of us like me, and I think you also said the same, that travel a lot or traveled a lot pre-pandemic, all of a sudden not being able to meet people and go and meet people in person, that was incredibly hard. Yeah. You know, like you and I haven't met in person yet, and you're in LA, and pre-pandemic I would have said, hey, you know, I'm in LA probably next month, you know, we should grab lunch, whatever. We can still say that now, but we both know that the odds of that happening are, I don't know.
Yeah.
And so I think, and that's true for people that travel, but also for people that don't travel. I know a lot of people here in Atlanta who are, you know, don't travel that much, but all of a sudden not being able to go to dinner parties or to go bowling together or to go to church or school or work, that just hit everybody. And I think, you know, kind of what, so that's what's most grateful, is to have those relationships, even relationships like you and me that we're able to develop even virtually. So I'm grateful. Yeah. I'm grateful for video conferencing. How's that? But what I'm most hopeful for is to get all that in-person interpersonal relationships back, to be able to kind of go see people again, to be able to go to LA and have lunch with you, you know? So
I'm and then, you know, I always believed, I guess, that there's a reason for everything. Mother Nature is as pissed off as she could ever be right now. She's thrown everything at us. And so hopefully we have learned from this, because otherwise it would be a bigger tragedy than it's become, that exactly what you're saying, we don't take for granted, you know, sitting at a restaurant with a friend, a family member or whatnot, and really like, damn, this is good. You know, this is good. And, yeah. And making the best of it. So hey, that's awesome. I can't wait to have lunch with you on Venus or up in the air on Venus sometime in the very far future, maybe a future life, but fascinating stuff you're doing, and congrats on really being a leader who cares about making an impact out there. So thanks for sharing all this.
Thank you. No, I appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to The Brand Called You videocast and podcast, a platform that brings you knowledge, experience, and wisdom of hundreds of successful individuals from around the world. Do visit our website, www.tbcy.in, to watch and listen to the stories of many more individuals. You can also follow us on YouTube, Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Just search for The Brand Called You.